G'day everyone. For those of you watching this video, the scene behind today is Melbourne. So the YAL Tour is now on the final leg. And if you are watching, well actually the scene behind me is mostly a Melbourne freeway. And then just over that side is the convention centre as well. So the YAL Tour is in the final leg. Last week I came to you from Brisbane. So if you remember, YAL goes from, where do we go from? We did a couple of days in Sydney, a couple of days in Brisbane, a couple of days now in Melbourne. I will have the final slot this afternoon doing the closing keynote for YAL at the biggest event as well, which would be really cool. In fact, I did the closing keynote in Brisbane the other day too. And I don't know if it was like the style of the room, because it was much more sort of an auditorium kind of room where for me, everyone's kind of, you know, sitting up there looking down, or if it was the fact that we kind of, it was just the end of the event, everyone's a bit chilled out, or the fact we're going to go and drink beer afterwards because they had that just outside the doors. I think everyone's very excited about that. But it was just a really, really super good audience. And it's interesting for me as a speaker doing like exactly the same talk in multiple places with the same conference and same organisers and having different levels of engagement and feedback. So look, Sydney was good. Don't get me wrong. If you're from Sydney, thank you for coming and watching my talk. But there was just an energy in Brisbane which was quite different. So I'm really curious to see what it's like here today. Apparently there were about 700 people in Sydney, about 500 in Brisbane, and about 1,000 in Melbourne. So I have a much bigger audience today, which will be interesting. So the YAL Tour will wrap up as of the Savo. And then that will be it for the conferencey things this year. I do still have another event on my calendar. In fact, I can tell you what this is because it's literally on my calendar. If I go to my laptop, one of the ways I keep track of where on earth I've got to be is I literally publish them on the front page of my website. So if you were to go to troyhunt.com, where am I going to be next week? Next week, I am going to be doing a public event, which is a Microsoft Cybersecurity Roundtable in Oslo. So I'm going to be an awful lot colder next week when I come to you. And I'll be seeing some Microsoft folks there. I've also got some other things to do there cyber-wise. I'm not sure if I can speak about those or not, but this one is definitely on the list, and I believe you can come along to that. So if you're in Oslo next week, come catch me. I will look much less summery by that time because apparently all the temperatures are well below freezing now. So different part of the world. Now, other things. So, that's YAL. YAL has been good. I do a blog post from this week I want to talk about. A couple of other things first, though. One of them is I am in the midst of updating winohttps.com. So, if you haven't seen this site before, you go to winohttps.com and you have the 100 largest websites in the world not forcing HTTPS connections by default, listed on the front page. So they're not 301ing or 302ing via a response header. You can then drill down on a country-by-country basis and see the top 50 for each country. And this is a site that Scott Helm and I put together based on his crawler stats. So he used to crawl the Alexa top 1 million. One thing he does differently now, and he spoke about this a couple of months ago when he did his six-monthly web statistics blog post that he does. We used to use Alexa. Few reasons why Alexa doesn't really work anymore. We now use a list called Trenko, which gets data from multiple different places, but it's a different ranking system. There are going to be a few little differences, but yeah, for the most part, it's still the same sort of premise, like world's biggest websites. So I have been preparing that. I started getting into that on the plane from Brisbane down to Melbourne the other day because it's a couple of hours flight. It is harder than it sounds. Like a lot of people go, why don't you just automate it? Well, there's a whole bunch of really screwy things that happen. I think I can automate it in the future. It's a question of whether I want to invest the effort to write the code to automate it. But anyway, I will try and wrap that up over the coming days because I'm quite fascinated as well to see who's left. One of the things I'm putting in the draft blog post I've written is in the period of time since I think it was about the middle of 2018 where Scott and I first launched that site to now, the percentage of traffic loaded by HTTPS connections over the web has gone from 70% to 80%, which is actually a pretty big jump when you think about it. It's like a 15% jump in the space for about 18 months. So that's good news. It is interesting to see who's left though, because I've sort of got this list, and of course I'm going through, say, the Aussie ones that I'm most familiar with. So the biggest Aussie one still not doing HTTPS by default is BOM, the Bureau of Meteorology. I don't know why, but anyway, they're not doing it by default. So anyway, I'm going to try and get that list completed and published. There are going to be false positives in there just simply by virtue of the fact that if you make a connection to a website, you may get routed in different ways to if I make a connection to a website. Some of them have got some funny WAF things in there, which don't redirect traffic. They just give you like 403 over an HTTP response. So, okay, if you're a normal person, you'd go to the correct website, but the very fact that they're happy to respond over HTTP and not force everything to HTTPS is problematic. One thing that I am looking at doing differently with this set of stats is to take the HSTS preload list, and if a website is on the preload list, they definitely don't make the YNO HTTPS list. Because so long as that preload list is rolled out to the browser won't allow you to make an insecure connection anyway. And of course, the preload list, in order to be on the preload list, you do actually have to successfully redirect traffic. So it just allows us to take what's somewhere in the order of 50,000 odd domains at the moment and say, look, if you're on that list, you get a free pass on YNO HTTPS. That's my thinking at the moment. I literally only imported the list this morning and I haven't actually done the match yet to see how many sites that would take out of the list where they would otherwise appear to have no HTTPS. All right, so that's that. That is going to be coming shortly. I might even be able to get that out next week if I'm lucky. A few other things. Oh, man. I just saw a tweet this morning. This bugged me, so I want to talk about it. A tweet which was a screen cap of a Facebook post by GoGetSSL. Now, how shall we explain this? Where did I put it? I think I put it in my Twitter feed here. Oh, no, I didn't put it there. All right, so GoGetSSL. Now, this is going to be another case of CAs doing some dodgy stuff, which frankly is very, A, misleading, and B, unnecessary. Now, this popped up on my feed, and these guys have chimed in at some stage as well, which is a bit screwy. All right, so this is a sponsored ad that someone has seen on Facebook. And the ad says this: tired of complicated setup and 90-day renewals? Get trusted, low-cost SSL certificates within just 5 minutes using a friendly and automated system. And then ellipses off. But the whole premise of this is about saying, are you tired of complicated setup and 90-day renewals? This is like, why would I be tired of something that happens automatically and I don't have to pay any attention to it anyway? So yeah, that was part of it. But the other thing is that the big banner in the middle of their image here says, get cheap 4-year SSL. So they're saying, get rid of the 90-day thing, get 4 years worth of SSL. Now, that is at best misleading, at worst just an outright lie. And Scott Helms chimed in on this. He says, 4-year certificates, I highly doubt that, given it to be a breach of the baseline requirements. Care to comment? Go get SSL. So he's now tweeted them into the thread. So baseline requirements only allow for a maximum of, I think it's 27 months for a certificate. And of course, there was recently a proposal to reduce that even further because long-running certificates pose all sorts of other problems. Now, GoGetSSL has then chimed in. Dear Scott, it's rather formal. So, dear Scott, please read the wiki about SSL subscriptions. For security reasons, the CA browser guidelines, SSL issued for 27 months, and later you just get a new file for another period. Now, and they then go on and say, actually, Sectigo already offering 5-year SSL. Grammar not a strong point, apparently. So what they're saying here is that what CAs will do is they'll offer you certificates for a period of time that exceeds the baseline requirements. Now, you don't actually get a certificate that runs longer than that period. What you do is you pay in advance to get the certificate renewed later on. And then, of course, because it's a manual process, then they send you the certificate and you have to go through and manually renew it. And I've sort of chimed in here as well, and I've said, so it's not a 4-year SSL, it's half that. Then you need to go through the rigor of manual reinstallation and actually pay money for it in an era of free and automated certs. Got it. As Scott says, I love how their ad complains about frequent renewal and at the same time lies about renewal frequency, which is just, it's just so consistently shady. And I don't understand why they need to be so deceptive. I mean, is it, and this is, I guess, a rhetorical question, but is it that the strength of the product cannot stand up on its own merits? Do they have to misrepresent what it does in order to get people to buy it? And if that's the case, why don't we have regulators clamping down on this? I've been really, really tempted, actually, to go and make a complaint like Fair Advertising Standards here in Australia. If I can find a CA advertising in Australia with crap like this, or advertising things like getting the green address bar with an EV SSL. So, okay, well, that doesn't happen. You're not allowed to mislead consumers that way. I wonder what would happen if we made a complaint. In my spare time, I'm going to test that. All right, so that's those guys. Now, something else that popped up just before I started recording this, and it's another one of these things that really bugs me, and actually I opened up a reference on the PC here as well, and it's kids' tracking watches. Now, you wouldn't believe this, but apparently kids' tracking watches have got some serious security vulnerabilities. So the one that's popped up just here is a story on CNET from today, maybe yesterday, American time. It says, the title of this is, "These kids' smartwatches have security problems as simple as 123. Byline, the default password on these smartwatches sold on Amazon could let hackers track and eavesdrop on children." Now, I only sort of read this as I was walking up to the hotel here before recording this, but it looks like Rapid7 has gone to town on these things. Their smartwatches cost less than $40, marketed as tracking devices to keep tabs on kids and allow parents to send messages and phone calls to their children. This sounds eerily familiar, doesn't it? The watches are also accepted configuration commands through text messages, which means a potential hacker could change settings on the watch, putting the children at risk. Oh, man. And anyway, it basically just seems to be the same old crap with these smartwatches, like just crazy, crazy low-hanging vulnerabilities in devices that are meant to keep your kids safe. Another glaring flaw Rapid7 found was that there's no way to contact manufacturers behind three smartwatches sold on Amazon. Without any way to reach out to the company, Rapid7's researchers raised concerns that there would be no way to fix these vulnerabilities. They also found that three smartwatches had the exact same default password. You ready for this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. It's unlikely people would change this password, as the devices don't even tell the users that passwords exist or how to change it. Yep. Now, one of the reasons I just found this particularly interesting is, obviously I was really involved with this TikTok track watch situation back earlier this year. I think it was about April. So this is the one where my mate Ken Munro in the UK said, look, I think these things have got egregiously bad vulnerabilities being sold in Australia, marketed at parents to watch their kids. Of course, they did have egregiously bad security vulnerabilities. They had to get yoinked offline, fixed, embarrassed company, came out, and eventually kind of admitted fault, but also wanted to throw a lot of blame at Ken and I as well. In fact, I was just looking at some of my notes when I did a search, and yeah, some of the comments that were made directed towards Ken and I, who did report this privately, wait until the things were offline, the vulnerability was certainly no longer exploitable before going public, like did everything right that we'd accept in this industry. Some of the comments were not very nice. So we're going to keep getting mileage out of it. Now, to that effect, when I was just searching through my tweet history here, I noticed on the 25th of November, Graham Cluley shared a story. Chinese children's watches reveals location and data of thousands of children. And then the story basically goes through the same old crap as we've always seen, just as in this case just here, just as in the TikTok track situation. And I quote tweeted this. And I said, this follows the findings the Ken Munro Show and I made earlier this year in TikTok track, which followed findings of, geez, didn't write this tweet very well, other kids watched before that. This pattern is alarmingly predictable. So the point I was making here is that this is an alarmingly predictable pattern. We saw it with TikTok track. We'd seen it with watches before that. We'd seen it with the one that Graham had tweeted here. Now, TikTok track chimed in and they said, TikTok Track has invested heavily in ensuring we remediated any findings from April and are committed to working with industry experts to ensure we are mitigating any risks. Now, I want to put that in the context of what their website said at the time that they had all those vulnerabilities. So we got this tweet here where I've said, look, this is an alarming trend. We keep seeing kids' watches over and over and over again have alarmingly bad security vulnerabilities, just like TikTok Track did. They've gone, we take security seriously. Their website, and I've got this on my screen here because it's part of my keynote for Yale, is the title here. First of all, it's got a padlock on the page, so you know that everything's going to be okay. Then it says, TikTok Track software is custom built and securely hosted in Brisbane, Queensland. One secure. Byline there, we take the security of your data seriously and have invested in developing our own platform. A little bit contradictory. developing our own platform for all devices to connect to. So the point I'm making here is they put a lot of emphasis on saying how secure their thing was at the time when it wasn't. It was egregiously bad. And when I look at the tweet thread here, they're putting a lot of emphasis on saying how secure that you see why I'm a little bit suspicious about the whole thing. So I might just add to this thread. I might just put a little bit more into this because this is... I might even keep this thread going. And as we see more kids' tracking watches have the same vulnerabilities, I'll just keep adding to the thread and it'll just be like, okay, so here's the history of kids' tracking watches having egregiously bad vulnerabilities. Now, onto something else that I think is egregiously bad. And this is this week's blog post. Now, I did talk about this in the weekly update last week, but it just had enough traction on Twitter even after I spoke about it, where I was like, look, I've got to articulate this more clearly. And the title of this blog post is Generated Passwords, UX and Security Absolutism. Now, I've written about security absolutism before in the context of Cloudflare. And I used that term then because people would say things like, when you use Cloudflare and you see the padlock in the browser, the only thing that's telling you is you've got an encrypted connection between the browser and a Cloudflare edge node. And they've got a couple of hundred of those around the world now. You could have no encryption whatsoever between the edge node and the origin website. Therefore, showing the padlock is disingenuous. This is like just as bad as having no security at all, which is a ridiculous statement to make, particularly given most of the threats that most people are worried about are close to the client, somewhere between the client and the Cloudflare edge node. And the security absolutism point I was making is that it's absolutism to say that you've got to encrypt everything from end to end, otherwise it's no good. That's not true at all. Yes, there is still a component of risk, but you can be very objective about how much that risk actually matters in the context of the particular class of website, the threat actors, the impact if it's compromised. So that was absolutism. Now, this is absolutism as well insofar as the premise that I spoke about last week was this website, which was, what's the name of these again? Oh, look at this. They've deleted the tweet. What are the joys of embedding tweets in a blog post like this is that when Twitter generates the embed code, it generates a block quote with the original text. Now, if ever the actual tweet gets deleted, the picture of the tweet where it normally has the, you know, the avatar photo and it's got, you know, icons to do things like retweet, etc., all of that goes away, but because the tweet itself was block quoted, you still got the original tweet. So what happens is when someone deletes a tweet like this, it becomes abundantly clear that they've since gone back and deleted it. And I've only just realized this, which, sorry, this page doesn't exist, which is really interesting. Why have they deleted it? Unless they've blocked me. That would make this even more interesting. PPentestLabs. So what tweets do they have left? That is interesting. Let me scroll back a few days. I wonder how much stuff's been deleted. Ooh. Looks like I've deleted it all. Have they deleted it all? All the discussion? Oh, no, some of that discussion's still here. Anyway, let me go back to the actual story. I've got to go back to the blog post now. So they had tweeted about the fact that they are generating the password for the user. So when you go and register for the site, you put in a username, you put in an email address, and then they send you an email and they go, in plain text, here's your password. And they store it in the database in plain text as well. Now, the discussion sort of centered around a couple of key things. Number one was they said, by generating the password, we have solved credential stuffing, because your password will be unique. You will not have used it anywhere else. Now, this is true. We've got to give them credit for this. And in the opening of this blog post of mine, I wrote about Disney. And I explained how Disney Plus had just gone through a massive credential stuffing attack. They got absolutely hammered very, very soon after launching because people reuse passwords. So clearly, password reuse and consequently credential stuffing is a major, major problem. No arguments whatsoever about that. So why doesn't Disney Plus just generate passwords? Well, the reason they don't is because it's an absolute UX nightmare. what are people going to do? They've got to try and store it somewhere. You can't write down the generated one, so they're going to have to copy and paste it into a text file or something like that, and you've got a text file full of passwords. Or they're going to have to go and do password resets using email. That's got problems because emails can be delayed, and then there's spam, and then there's all the rest of it. So it's just a UX nightmare. This is why we don't see it anywhere. Regardless of how much you like this pattern, you never, ever, ever see it outside of really obscure, bizarre little websites like the one doing it here. So the security absolutism bit was when people say you should generate passwords that are random strings and give it to people because it solves credential stuffing, that completely discounts everything else. And actually, let's see if they've deleted other tweets here. This will be fun. Because they made other tweets supporting their position. Yeah, they did. All right. But it's quote tweeted, so it's, well, it's not quote tweeted, but there's a block quote, so it's here. So, you know, one of the screwy things they said is, we are willing to trade UX anytime if it means more security for our users. No, you're not, because you don't have 2FA. So you don't give people the option 2FA. Clearly, you're not trading UX for security, because that's exactly what 2FA is. Also, it's not that simple. You don't just go, yes, we are willing to focus just myopically solely on security at the expense of everything else. It's crazy. Otherwise, you go, okay, everyone's got to have a U2F key. We're going to ship you a U2F key. Or you've got to buy a U2F key, because UX is something that they will trade every single time for security. But that doesn't make any sense. Oh, look, they deleted the other one as well. Oh, this is fascinating. So basically, their passwords can't be changed. If you want it changed, you have to get in touch with them, and then they just manually email you another one. By unchangeable, we meant that we do have the option within the dashboard. We do not have the option within the dashboard. So handy, this block quote is here. But if the user emails us, we will be able to assist on that. For paid accounts, we verify the request using the PayPal transaction from our PayPal account. Wow, okay, now isn't this curious? So they're the only ones who've deleted tweets, and they've just deleted the ones that I embedded. I find that much more amusing than I probably should, but anyway. Now, the interesting side outcome out of this as well, where a number of people said they have seen cases in the past where a website has generated passwords for them. And then what they've done is they've taken that password and then they've just used it on all the other websites where they can set their own password. So it doesn't actually solve password reuse. So I would argue that that's a pretty stupid practice in terms of taking a generated password and using it everywhere else. But people are right, unless every website generates it. And then, like, the whole internet is just an absolute pain in the ass to use. But isn't that bizarre? Such a bizarre thing. So anyway, look, I kind of made these arguments. 20 comments on this, so it hasn't gone too crazy. But I don't think ultimately anyone has sort of come up with a good reason why you should actually do this. And certainly as I finished the blog post, I said, by all means, people should robustly debate the merits of alternate auth systems, but you cannot escape the reality that no matter how endorsed you might be in this approach, websites simply don't implement it. There are very good reasons why not. And if you're inclined to chime in on the comments section in support of generated passwords, perhaps start with thinking about why this approach is so rarely seen. And this is sort of one of these things I come back with, just the same with EV certificates and anything else that's really, really rarely seen. What is the reason? The reason is not that, well, nobody ever thought about it before. The reason is there are other fundamental barriers to adoption. It might be usability, it might be cost, it might be the fact that in a case like EV, it doesn't actually do anything and it has other risk factors. So I always sort of come back to this, like, we haven't arrived at this position in the industry just entirely by accident and everything was just a fluke. There are normally decision processes that go into, do I do things like generate a password? And the first thing that would happen, if ever you actually went and put this system out in front of any tester or anyone who had to ultimately make the call on, are we willing to implement this and then impose the barrier to adoption, is they're going to come back and go, no, we're not going to implement this. This is why you can't sign up to any of the major sites you use and have them just generate the password. There are other alternatives, of course, to avoid having to store a user password which could be reused. You could use social media logins, for example. If I was worried about things like credential stuffing and I really wanted to collect passwords, I'd use Azure Active Directory services or Authy or something where someone else then becomes responsible for managing credential stuffing and all the rest of it that comes with it. But yeah, don't do this. Don't do this. This is just nuts. Okay, so last thing is, this week's sponsor is also Whois XML API. Again, I mentioned last week, this is a service that I have actually used for many years as well. They're talking about the top domain Whois DNS IP and threat intelligence provider for the MDR, SIEM, digital forensics, and threat hunting. So who is XML API? Again, I really like it when I have a sponsor that I have actually paid money for in the past, because it means I am genuinely endorsed in it, regardless of the fact that it is product placement for them. So please go and check them out. Give them some support for supporting what I do as well. So that's it. I'm going to wrap this up. I've got to go and do my keynote first. I actually want to add something into this talk. Each time I try and just change it a little bit, something new, and I've got something fun I'm going to add into this one. And then, crikey, next week I'm going to come to you from Oslo. So it's going to be a much colder setting over there. And again, if you are around Oslo on Thursday next week, come and check out that session. There is a link to it in the events thing on the side of my blog. So thank you very much for watching, and I'll see you next week from the other side of the world.